guys, and welcome to episode 179 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interviewed Dr. Lisa Coyne. Lisa works at the Child and Adolescent OCD Institute at McLean Hospital and is also founder of the New England Center for OCD and Anxiety. And I wanted to get her on because, A, I heard her talk in 2017 on ACT and ERP, and I found it really fascinating. But also I wanted to get her on because she specializes in children and adolescents, so I wanted to cover more of that on the podcast. And the interview didn't disappoint. Lisa goes into her therapy story, what is acceptance commitment therapy. She also gives client examples or case examples of how she actually applies ACT to treating OCD in children and adolescents. Whether you're a parent or a child or teenager, if you're just someone, an adult with OCD, then I think you'll still find this interesting. But she goes into detail in, specifically ACT, but then also how ACT supercharges, can supercharge exposure and response prevention therapy. So I found that very interesting. We also talk about inpatient treatment for children, because I wanted to do some destigmatizing around that in case there is any. And how parents can be more treatment supporting, and we know it's a tough job supporting anyone going through anything, but to see your child suffering can be very tough. So I wanted to ask Lisa's advice on that to help any parents listening. There's so much more that's covered in this. I think this is going to appeal to everyone, but also specifically any children, adolescents, or parents or caregivers. So thank you to Lisa and for you guys for listening. And without further ado, here is Dr. Lisa Coyne.
On the podcast today, I have Dr. Lisa Coyne. Lisa is an assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is senior clinical consultant at the Child and Adolescent OCD Institute at McLean Hospital, and is also the founder of the New England Center for OCD and Anxiety. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, it's good to have you on. I think I had you on my list of potential guests in 2017, in July, when I saw you speak. So
wow,
it's taken me a while, but...
I'm glad we met up finally.
Absolutely. So it'd be great to hear your therapy story. So I guess why become a therapist, and also why specifically for OCD?
Why did I become a therapist? So there's probably a lot of reasons, but the one thing that, you know, people have asked me this before, and a couple of things, like I really, really enjoy working with people. But when I was a teenager and my family went through struggles, I was frequently sent to talk to therapists about, you know, marital issues and who we should live with and all of that kind of thing. And I remember talking to them, and more than anything else, what I think I wanted at that point was just for somebody to get it, that things were hard and I really needed somebody to get it and to really hear me. And they didn't. And they really sucked. I remember I was a little bit oppositional, and I used to think, my God, there's got to be something better than this, you know? And I guess while that was a hard experience, I took it with me, and it's one of the things that directs how I work with young people, and it's one of the things that's important to me when I see them. So no matter what the issue is, you know, that they feel held and heard. So that's one thing. And why OCD? Well, so I did my doctoral training down at the University of Mississippi with, I had fabulous mentors. I had, they're both very dear to me, Alan Gross, and Kelly Wilson came into the, you know, into the group, I suppose, when I was a few years into grad school and I started working with him. And while I was down there, most of my work was around aggression. It was around kids and reactive aggression and proactive aggression. I did a lot of school research, did a lot of work with parents. I did a lot of school consultation, but I spent a lot of time with little oppositional kids. And when I went to my postdoc at Brown, I really wanted to round out my experience and work with kids with anxiety, because I did not have very much experience at that at all. And I was really, really blessed to match at Brown. And I worked with the amazing and brilliant Abby Garcia and Jennifer Freeman and Henrietta Leonard, who was my mentor there, and she's passed away. But that's where I fell in love with working with OCD. I just loved it. I loved it from the, you know, everything I learned from them. I worked with another mentor with adults with anxiety and OCD also. His name was Don Posner, another really fabulous person. I think one of the things that struck me about working with these kids and these families was their incredible bravery, their incredible tenacity. And it's really incredibly hard to face those things that you fear the most. And it's also really, it's hard as a clinician to really get that and ask them to do it anyway. And so it was always such an honor. Like, I just took that so seriously when I worked with these kids and these families, like the work that they were doing, and watching them transform afterward and get their freedom, that was incredible. So that's really where I fell in love with it. And I worked, I was an assistant, after that I was at Suffolk University. I was a professor there for a number of years, and I loved that work, but I didn't really have a ton of interaction with kids and families with OCD. I did a lot of consulting. I did a lot of work in early childhood. I did see clients. But lo and behold, about 5 years ago, Diane Davey approached me from McLean and said, do you want to start a child residential clinic for OCD? And I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. You know, and I was terrified because, of course, that meant I had to leave Suffolk and give up tenure. You give up your, you know, your job for life. And a number of people were like, you're crazy. Why would you do that? And I was like, well, because I actually really, really want to do this. I really love this work. And so I did.
Nice. And how's it worked
and
out?
Here we are. And here we are. And so I branched out. So I set it up, directed it for a number of years, and then went part-time, opened my own clinic, and now I'm kind of spending part-time at McLean and part-time here.
Oh, nice. No, thank you for going into that. It's quite a journey. And yeah, I can completely relate to wanting kids to feel heard. That's one of my motivations for training with children.
Yeah.
Because I didn't feel heard, and I just wanted someone to hear. So it's quite powerful. So yeah, that resonated with me. Okay, so you obviously do ARP, and we're going to get into that, but you also specialize in ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. So I guess before we go into the questions on ACT, just briefly, it'd be good to, anyone doesn't know what ACT is, kind of what is it in a few sentences?
What is ACT in a few sentences? Okay. ACT is, you know, it's a therapeutic approach. It can be a philosophy of living. And generally speaking, it's based in behavior analytic principles. So it's got a nice evidence base. And it's basically about helping people build lives that they really love waking up into every day. And looking at things that get in the way of doing that, including what they call private events, which mean your thoughts, your feelings, things like that. Yeah, should I say more?
Only if you want.
As nice as I could. So it has different elements. It has kind of two broad classes of, I guess, processes or interventions. And one is one half, or the first one is the acceptance and mindfulness processes. And those are all about how you pay attention to the world, the space that you make for things that are difficult, sort of flexible noticing of things. And the second half are, you know, the commitment and behavior change processes. That's sort of the engine of ACT, right? That's the, you know what, this is really hard and I'm going to do it anyway because it's really, really important to me. And so I love that it has both pieces. And I fell into it in graduate school. I was trained in applied behavior analysis at Mississippi, and I was also trained in cognitive behavior therapy. And they were great, you know. And we had this one class where we had to do an assignment. It was a class by a guy named Stan O'Dell. And he said, you know, the assignment was, if you could make up your own therapy, what would you do? What would it look like? And I really loved, you know, evidence-based stuff because I'm a scientist and I want stuff that works. It's nice to be able to trust the intervention that you're using, yeah. Right? But one of the things that always struck me in working with families was, like, it was really easy to tell them, like, you know what needs to be done. You know kind of what the changes are that have to happen. It's helping people actually do those changes when it's really hard. You know, how do you bring them to that? You know, because people are pretty good at making small changes or even bigger changes when it's easy. But when can we curse on this?
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
You knew it was coming.
Yeah.
When the shit hits the fan, it's really hard to do those things. So I always thought, like, one thing that I wished was built into CBT was sort of that, how do we get people to these, like, aha moments, you know? And so Kelly came to the university, and I was like, oh, you know, let me look. You know, I was kind of researching who he was. I had no idea. And I was looking at the book that was associated with him, and it was called something like Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, an Experiential Approach to Behavior Change. And I was like, that's really cool. Maybe that's the way to get to those, like, aha moments where people can be like, yeah, I'm doing it, you know? Mm. And so it was. It was really cool.
Yeah.
So I think that it dovetails. It is a cognitive behavioral therapy. Early on in ACT, people used to be like, oh, well, what's different about it and what's new? And yeah, it takes things a little bit differently. But at its heart, it is a cognitive behavioral. It's part of the cognitive behavioral tradition. Mm. Insofar as it, you know, allows analysis, I suppose, of your thoughts and your feelings in private events.
Yeah.
Right. Just look at things functionally, how they work, rather than what they are and what the thoughts are and what we're thinking.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the mechanics effectively behind the thinking as opposed to the actual content. Is that
exactly.
What
you say? Yeah. Kind of, yeah. Like how do you interact with the thought rather than what is the thought?
Yeah.
Right? So, like, it's more important to understand that if I... So when I was a grad student, I'll tell a story to illustrate this. I had my daughter in grad school, and I actually started to have this weird thing happening where when she was an infant, whenever I was going to work or far away from her, I would have these recurrent horrific images of harm happening to her. Does this sound familiar, Stuart?
Yeah.
So I, you know, and I remember they were so... viscerally terrifying. I'd be driving to do my consulting and I would almost drive off the road because it would take my breath away, and it'd be images of her, like, falling and crushing her skull, or like of her choking, you know?
Yeah.
And right. So anyway, so a little bit of postpartum OCD, we do have some of that and anxiety in our family as well. So, but just to use that as an illustration, you know, an ACT would be more interested in, well, when that thought shows up, what do you do? Do you drive home? Do you call? Do you check? Do you do something about that to mitigate it? Whereas in CBT, you might kind of talk to yourself about the probability of that occurring and the likelihood and all of that stuff, right? Mm. So the ACT approach might be, wow, I'm really terrified, and this is a really scary thought that I'm having. And I'm going to notice that thought, and I'm going to continue driving towards this consultation gig, because that's really, really important. You know, and I'm sure, and we'll see what happens, right?
Yeah.
So it's teaching people how to change how they interact with their thinking, which is really, as you might notice, similar to exactly what you might do in an ERP. So ACT is an exposure-based approach, which is one of the reasons it dovetails so nicely with exposure and response prevention. The thing that I like about using the two of those things together is that it heightens clinicians' attention to really understanding the function of behavior and the function of what people are doing in certain events. Because I think if you miss that, you might miss, you might not set up your ERP exercises properly, and they might work as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah. No, thanks.
You probably could talk for hours, and I'm having the thought that I'm nerding out here. And I'm really sorry. Do not reassure me.
Yeah. Well, I do have a sore throat, so the more talking you can do, the better. So I don't know if that was reassurance, but it was a cop out. Cool. So then on that note then, just, you know, I know the listeners really love sort of case examples or like they're especially with ACT, they can you often get their heads around ERP, but ACT can be sometimes people would never really go into detail. So any kind of examples you have working with OCD, I guess specifically children, and where you either use ACT in and of itself or you merge ACT with ERP.
God, there's so many. I'm trying to think of like, who do I start with? So I might start with my pal, Ethan, who helped us write the intro to, so we being myself and my colleague from New Zealand, Ben Sedley. So we've just finished a book for teenagers called Stuff That's Loud. And it's all about unspiraling from OCD. We're really excited about it because it was, something dear to our heart. And so it was something that really developed because I used to give Ben's first book to the kids on our unit, right? And his first book was called Stuff That Sucks. And I was just charmed by the teen in me, the 16-year-old me, just loved that and thought, I love the irreverence of it. And the principles were so solid. And the kids, indeed, at McLean loved it as well. And they always said to me, like, why doesn't he do one for OCD? Why doesn't he write one for OCD? So I actually met him at a conference and said, Ben, so the kids on the unit have a request. And he was like, that's a great idea. Do you want to do it with me? So we ended up doing it together. And as we wrote it, you know, really, I can't think of a tougher audience to write for than teenagers, can you?
No.
Right? So we showed them everything and we were like, please tell us what's stupid and we'll take it out. And, you know, there's anything that you think we should include that we didn't, we'll put it in. And they were great. And one of the kids that helped down the road from this was a kid, Ethan, who, along with Cheryl, ended up helping us write the intro to the book. So Ethan he's a great kid. And he's now studying in New Zealand. He just met Ben. He's, like, studying abroad for a semester. And that was wild, like, having all of the worlds collide. But, you know, like a lot of kids who come to our unit, he was really, really stuck with his OCD. He was, you know, it was a tough, tough situation where he had a lot of emotional contamination stuff going on. And he was really, really, like he describes it himself, like ritualizing in his head basically 24/7. And one of the things that he said to me was that his days, you know, he'd sit in the same couch in the same seat for months, unable to move because it was too hard to move because he would have to do rituals. And he said basically he'd wake up and he would think about, you know, how do I make the day as least miserable as possible until I can go to sleep and not feel anything again, right? And so he had ERP elsewhere. And he had not made headway. And that is a theme in a lot of the kids that come to McLean. For some reason, it didn't work. And so our job is sort of to figure out why. Like, what was it that didn't work? And there's a lot of reasons. It's not just one. But one of them is that, you know, the kids sometimes they're not able to access it because they're not really in their bodies when they're doing when they're doing their ERPs, right? They're not really paying attention. So avoidance, so in other words, they're white knuckling. They're distracting in some covert way that's really hard to tell. And it's really hard. Like, there's not great language, like very precise language around, like, how do you do ERP? So this is where the ACT piece comes in for me. And we have like a very integrated model where, like, it's really hard to tell where the ACT begins and the ERP ends. But the very first thing we would do is to coach the kids to learn how to pay attention, right? How do you discriminate, like, when you're up in your thoughts and you're spinning versus bringing your attention through your five senses to the present moment? And a first step might just be that. Like, let's practice noticing when you're up in your thoughts and when you're not. And what's that like? And let's notice that as a choice. Because sometimes when kids are, you know, when they're really stuck, they don't know the difference. You know, they can't tell the difference. They can't make that shift. So we might start there. The next thing we might do, right, and that's sort of the present moment component event. The next thing we might do is have them really, you know, separate out their OCD from themselves. Like, what is your OCD saying versus what you're saying? Now, that's common to CBT too. So that's another nice kind of dovetail. That's across both traditions. And we would have them really notice whatever the rules were that OCD would give them about how to behave. And we wouldn't necessarily say break the rules, but what we would say is, why don't we get curious about the rules? So for example, like Ethan would say, you know, on one hand, my mind is saying, you know, my OCD is saying it's horrible. If I do this horrible thing will happen. My rational mind is saying, like, nothing's going to happen. So I'm going to be sort of the non-judgmental observer in the middle going, well, why don't we just find out? Why don't we just do it and see what happens, right? Because when you're scared, when any organism is scared, your attention, all of your behaviors narrow to escape or avoidance, period, including your attention and what you're paying attention to. So the scope of what you can learn from in that moment is very limited because learning's not important. What is important to your brain, right, is escape. Yep. Get me the hell out of here. So the ACT piece about, well, let's step back from our thoughts and let's really get curious about, well, what's actually going to happen here? Like, what's going on in here, right? That's really central. And it's, you're teaching people in the presence of these really frightening thoughts and feelings, how do you do this thing that evolution has said that's a bad idea? Like, slow down, open your eyes, and look around you. Pause, right? And in fact, that's what we do in ERP, isn't it, right? You want kids to really be there, not just waiting till it's over. And so what we do on the front end is we teach both of those things, or all of those things, as we're starting to build a hierarchy, right? So the next thing we might do is we might assign what we call noticing exercises. So, like, we're going to start building, and we can do hierarchies with people like that. We also do menus because we are attentive to sort of the newer work on inhibitory learning and all of that stuff. Again, I'm geeking out. I'm really sorry. So we'll say, what we're going to do is we need your help, and we need for you to help us help you build this menu of options that you can choose to do for your ERP. So go out into the world and kind of, like, let's really see. So your OCD has given you a ton of rules about what you can or can't do. So let's actually check those. Like, let's test that and see, like, you know, what would it be like, and help us kind of come up with a list of things that you might do that are easy or hard or somewhere in the middle, and then come back and tell us about it. So we'll send them out to do sort of these curiosity exercises. We might also do little things like just teaching people how to lean into discomfort. So, like, and it doesn't even have to be OCD related, just to teach them that skill of like, how do you lean into stuff? So like, you're waiting in line, it's really annoying, you're super frustrated, you're in a rush, people around you are jostling you, it's just, and you want to get the hell out of there, and it's really frustrating. How do you say yes to that? You know, how do you practice kind of relaxing your body physically, allowing that feeling of irritation, frustration to be with you, etc. And just, it is what it is. It's going to be there, so we might as well make a space for it. So there's this sort of allowing, right? Anyway, so Ethan did all of this stuff. And then he also did some really, really cool stuff where he started to do exposures, right? And he experienced this because he really kind of listened and he really tried out this whole notion of let me be curious and let me work on being willing to notice and allow whatever thoughts and feelings show up to be here, right? So he did all of this and he noticed this really cool shift, right, between I'm not going to let myself do a ritual and I'm not going to let that happen to I'm going to start going after my OCD because I want to see what happens if I really poke at it and push at it. And he started this process pretty slowly and he said, you know, one of his first steps was to make a promise to himself about something that really mattered, right? And his promise to himself was he didn't want to be the kind of person that was held back by this. So he would do things like talk to friends, go out of his house, take a bike ride, go visit people, and actually be with them when he was with them, even if OCD was loud around him. And he did that in small steps. And then as he sort of accrued all of these tiny steps, he started really going after it, which was really cool. And that surprised him. But he was just exploring it. He wanted to see, like, what could this thing teach him? What could it do? And it was really cool to watch that process. And I remember one day we were doing an exposure, and he had emotional contamination from a family member who had sent him some clothes, right? Some contaminated, I'm doing the air quotes with my fingers. I don't know if people see that or not. And so what we decided to do was to put on a pair of socks from the contaminated family member. And he was sitting outside with me on a bench. And he was like, he looked pretty calm, but he started to tense up and he said, whoa. And I said, what's going on? And he said, wow, this is a really amazing feeling. And I said, well, what is it like? What's happening? And he said, I kind of feel like my throat's filling up with sand and that I'm not going to be able to breathe. And it's really scary. And I was like, wow, that sounds really scary. What are we going to do? And I said, you know, well, what would someone who couldn't breathe not do? Or what would they not be able to do? And he goes, I don't know, maybe I could run up and down the parking lot. And I was like, yeah, how about it? So he did. And wore the socks for the rest of the day, yeah. Right? So one important piece that I forgot to mention is that, you know, when we think of exposure from an ACT perspective, we don't talk about it in terms of we're going to reduce your symptoms, right? We love that when that happens. That's awesome. Everybody loves that. What we do talk about it as is increasing your ability to be flexible in the presence of whatever the scary thing is. So bringing it with you and doing stuff anyway, because it's important stuff, stuff that you care about.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Thank you for going into that. It was really useful. We could do a whole episode just on this. I will have to get you back on again to go into that in more detail. But there's so much more I still want to cover in the time we have left. So, thanks for the explanations. So something that came out to me as you were talking earlier, you obviously partly work in residential still, residential treatment. And yep. I guess stigma for that is going down year by year, which is good. But I'm sure some parents would still have some kind of issues and stigma around putting their child in a residential unit. And I guess the floor is yours for kind of appeasing some of those anxieties.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think about that a lot. I think about, like, what a terrifying thing it must be for a kid to be told, we think you should go there, and for a parent to, like, it just feels so big to me. And so when I founded the unit, it was really important to me to create a culture around what we were. And I didn't want to be the place where, like, the really, you know, the kids who were really struggling went, you know. I wanted to be the place that when you went there, we were going to help you get your life back. You were going to do that.
Yeah.
And this was the beginning of the rest of your life. And, you know, that would really matter to me. So, like, the whole unit is very much acceptance-based. The whole culture of it from, you know, our amazing secretary, Susan Grinzel, who I hope listens to this, to, all the way up to our new program director, Mark Picciotto, right? Everybody in between. And it's all about kind of, you know, one of the nice things about ACT is it's just got this really collaborative feel where it's like, you know, we all have our stuff. We all have minds that work the same way. We all struggle. And your stuff might be different from my stuff, but, like, there's no judgment there. Yeah. And we're guides. You have everything you need. These kids have everything that they need to build lives that they love. And we stand with that from the very beginning. From the very beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Cool. No, thank you for that. Yeah, yeah, it sounds like, I don't want to use the word positive because that's probably too simplistic, but it's a positive view from the get-go of, like you said, you're not, there's nothing wrong with you. You're fully capable. You have the ability that maybe you just need a hand right now. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like helping, we help people find their strength. You know, like, these kids walk in and these are, I'm not kidding when I say this, like, I really mean this, but these are some of the most amazing, resilient, powerful, strong, fantastic kids I have ever met in my life. They are absolutely among the bravest, you know, and they've taught me so much about so many things just in knowing them and watching them kind of walk the walk. They inspire all of us, I think, to be better at what we do, to work as hard as they do. So, yeah, it's a fun place to work.
Yeah, I bet.
I meet the best people. It's just awesome.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. And then similar then, so staying on the parents, so you have written a book, or it's about to come out, correct me if I'm wrong, on ACT for parenting, or an ACT-based approach to parenting. So feel free to plug that. but also just advice for how parents can, I've put the phrase here, be treatment supporting for their children with OCD. So that, I guess, to avoid doing the things like reassurance, giving reassurance and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's so scary for parents, and it's hard because, like, you know, OCD is tough because most parents, like, your natural instinct is going to be to make your child feel better, to feel less anxious, to make things easier. All of us feel that. I'm a parent too. And, like, I certainly have felt that with my kids. And of course, in the case of OCD, that is one of the things, unfortunately, that helps OCD thrive and grow in families is, you know, kind of doing what it needs you to do so that your child feels better. So, you know, one of the things that we work on is helping parents understand how all of that works and how over time they need to work on stopping their accommodation of OCD. And it's tough because it's it's just so counterintuitive to what you must feel as a parent. Like, what do you mean you want me to ask my child to, like, not wash their hands or not, you know, protect themselves? Of course, you know, this is too hard for them. They cannot do this, right? And so from an ACT approach, what we work on is really helping parents notice that, like, what is that like? And what are those things that show up for you, those thoughts and feelings that might get in the way of you sticking to your guns and being consistent and trusting that your child 100% has the strength they need to do hard things and that you believe in that, right? So a lot of it is that, and a lot of it is just kind of like talking with parents about how hard it is to, it's an extra weight. You know, there are manuals about how to parent, like, but when you're first starting, when you're first walking through this, you know, it's just so hard to know the right things to do, and parents beat themselves up all the time. You know, they can get very overprotective of their kids too, and that sometimes gets in the way. Sometimes they're too gung-ho. Sometimes they push too hard, and that can get in the way. So it's really striking a balance. And so what we have written about and there's a couple of books actually, is basically helping parents understand where your kiddo is at developmentally, because what you do with kids who are preschool versus school age versus adolescence is different. You know, it's got the same principles, but how you do it is very different. And what it feels like for parents at those ages is very, very different. So we'll help them with understand that, and in that context, help them identify what kind of parent do they most want to be, like what kind of, you know, person, like what kind of support do you want to be? And I can tell a little story to kind of illustrate that I sometimes tell in my workshops. So I have a fear of heights myself, and I didn't used to. I used to be like that bold kid that would jump off the cliff into the, you know, rock pool, and I was very adventurous. And then somewhere along the line, I started to get very frightened of heights, like to the point where if I was at the edge of something, I would actually like experience, no kidding, that like freeze. I could not move, like utterly paralyzed by fear. And we used to go to this summer camp with my kids in the Catskills, and it was really fun. It was kind of an Irish music camp thing. And it's still going on. It's really fun. Catskills Irish Arts Week, so woohoo for anybody interested in Irish music. But they had a great swimming hole behind one of the hotels where there was a cliff probably 15 feet up above the river that everybody would go and jump off. And it was just a thing. It was like, you know, it didn't look safe, but nobody died, so I'm, you know, was probably kind of safe. I don't know. You never really know.
Yeah.
And my kids were like on fire to go jump off this cliff. And I was all like, well, if you do it, I'll do it, because I'm an exposure therapist and I could do anything, right? So I remember like being in the water and climbing up, and trying to climb up and then freezing, unfortunately, because I got frightened and I couldn't move. And my daughter had, like, pushed me up by the bum, like, like to the top. And I was like, well, that's that. I'm not doing it. Not a value. I'm not going to jump. I don't care, right? But I was like, well, I'm going to let the kids jump. And it was really hard because I was really terrified that they were going to crack their heads and die on the way down. I mean, absolutely, utterly, like, you know, and I'd watch them. And every time they would try, you know, get close to the edge, I'd be like, be careful. And I noticed that every time I did that, they would wobble because I would freak them out because I was anxious and I was expressing that to them, right? And so I had to make a decision about, like, do I want to manage my anxiety or do I want to be a parent who encourages their exploration and their bravery? And so I would take a deep breath and I would shut the hell up. And sometimes I didn't watch, but most of the time I did. And I would let him go. And I would watch him jump. And I would take photos. And I have these great photos of him leaping off this thing. And, you know, because I did not want to be a parent who held them back. I wanted to be a parent who nurtured their mindful risk-taking and their adventurousness in the world such that they could learn from it. And so that's kind of how we approach parents with kids with OCD. How do we do that, right? How do we be mindful of that? How do we get parents in touch with that? Are you willing to, you know, feel really worried about your kiddo in the context of this if it means that's a huge step towards them learning how to be effective, independent, vibrant, engaged person in the world, right? So that's kind of the approach that we take.
Yeah, I like that. It's a good illustration. And it's going, like you said, going back to that value piece for the parents then. Like,
yeah,
as you said about them, was it being adventurous or exploring and living a more fulfilled life? And because it can, as you say, it can be hard to see your child suffer if you don't know why they're suffering.
Right.
Yeah. Because even if it's like the word recovery, it's like, yes, but what is recovery? What does it look like? What does it mean?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And sometimes the hardest thing is like with teenagers, and this is, so we have a book. So the book that you mentioned that's coming out is with myself and Koa Whittingham. It's a book on ACT, how to support parents with ACT across childhood. So birth to teens. Mm. And it's a more general book. But next year, I am working with my dear colleague, Phoebe Moore, the brilliant Phoebe Moore, who also is, you know, someone who's been working with OCD all of her career. And we are writing a book for Guilford on, you know, working with families of adolescents who have OCD. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about this. And one of the hardest things, I think, is when you get to adolescence, it's sitting on your hands a little bit and supporting the kids driving the bus instead of you directing all the time, right? There are many, many pieces to this, but in terms of where, you know, teens are developmentally, what we want to shape in, for example, McLean or in my private practice, is agency, their agency, their ability to take mindful risks, their ability to self-direct their own behavior, right? Because it's one thing if kids are like, you told me to do the exposure, so I did the exposure. It's another thing when they're coming into you going, hey, you know what? I just had this thought that this would be the coolest exposure. I felt really scared of that, so I think I should do exposure with that, right? So we want to support that self-direction when they become adolescents and that kind of continued engagement and leaning into things that are hard. And that's tough because that entails parents watching them try and fail, helping nudge them back on course when necessary, and then stepping back again. So it's a tough process, but it's one that I think can be really helpful for the kids at that age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Thank you for going into that. Towards the end, a couple of questions, which is, if you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old Lisa, what would you tell her?
You know, I it's so funny because I forgot that you asked that question. Shit. I should have had a prepared answer, damn it. I'm just thinking back to 20-year-old Lisa. 20-year-old Lisa was a bit of a hot mess. What would I tell her? I think I would tell her that things are going to be okay, and that it's really important to slow down and learn how to be in the world, you know, instead of listening to all the things that are scary. When I was 20, I was in college, and I remember One of the other things that I struggle with is social anxiety, right? Like really significant when I was younger. And in college, I just hated going out to parties because I just was like, I'm terrible at small talk. Everybody thinks I'm an idiot. Nobody likes me very much. And why should I go? And this is uncomfortable. And I would make myself go because I thought, well, you know, it's what the cool kids are doing. You should do it. But I'd be so miserable. But if I stayed home, I'd also be miserable because I'd be lonely, right?
Yeah.
And the whole experience was all about like those two poles, like either making myself be in situations I didn't like or being really sad because I wasn't in those situations. And neither of them were right. Mm. And so what I think I would tell her is there's a third option here. And the option is being willing to go and be curious and see what happens. Really notice the story you have spinning in your head and go and find out what will actually happen. And that's actually how I worked through that. And, you know, it doesn't bother me so much anymore, almost at all, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But I think I would tell her that. I would have taught her that a whole lot younger than she learned it.
Yeah. No, good advice.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So you've got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard for everyone to see?
Oh, my God. That's so hard because there's so many, like,
question.
I know, right? I'm having the thought that I'm overthinking it.
Is that what you'd have on the...
No. And I'm having thought now that I have to get the exact right phrase. So I'm sure it's not going to be the right phrase. I think... what's showing up for me right now is the phrase, you are stronger than you know. Mm. And I think I might say something like that. Because I think that people walk around, you know, whether they have OCD or whether they don't have OCD, really doubting their ability to change, their ability to really make a difference in the world, their ability to affect change in large or small scale. And, you know, people really are so much stronger than they know. And they're just, you know, one decision away from really having a different life. You know, it's like a small pivot from avoiding stuff that's hard to exploring stuff that's hard. Because that stuff is going to be there anyway. You know? So you can either live with it where you're just using all your energy and your efforts not to have it. Or, since it's here, you can turn towards it and lean in. And so I think I would say that would be my phrase. You're stronger than you know. Be curious. I'll add that.
We'll
have two phrases. Can I have two phrases?
Yeah, you can have two. I have an unlimited marketing budget, so.
Fantastic. I love that.
Well, look, thank you so much for your answers and obviously your time today. And I'll definitely get you on again.
Thanks so much, Stuart. This is so cool. I've been a fan of your work and your podcast for a really long time. I think that you do really, really good things in the world, and it's really kind of an honor to be on here. I'm dreadfully nervous, but I'm really glad I did it. It was so nice to talk to you today.
Yeah, likewise. I appreciate it. It means a lot.
So there you have it. Really hope you enjoyed my conversation with Lisa. And once again, thank you to her. And thank you to you guys for listening. And all information in show notes will be at theocdstories.com. A quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.